sure. Thank you very much for the introduction. So it's always good to be back in Santa Barbara. I think the first time I came here 19 years ago, and Antoine George gave me a ride from the airport to the institute, and the first word he said was, "Welcome to paradise." And I see Kate didn't lose their charm even until today. So our program is, the acronym for our program is NS Matter. And when I got this name, I was wondering, what the heck is this? And somebody in the administration looked like, cooked up. And does it mean lovely Santa Barbara or something like that? Anyway, so this represents the spin-off coupling. So we all know that spin-off coupling is a coupling between overall angular momentum and spin angular momentum. So even though in the scalar, this is, it's really a vectorial coupling. So I should have said delta S matter, I suppose. So the title of my talk today is topological phases. Basically using spin-orbit coupling. Okay. So, it's a pretty ambitious title, I realize, after giving this title. So hopefully I can give you some flavor of what condensed matter physicists think about topological phases and gauges. So, just to remind you what the spin-orbit coupling is, I think everybody knows. But as you know, the spin-orbit coupling is a relativistic effect. So when electrons move in some electric field with a velocity, then the electron's frame experience some negative field. So it's a purely relativistic effect. So if the electron has a spin, then there will be a coupling between spin of the electron and the magnetic field. So this just represents the Zeeman coupling, the Zeeman energy. So you just simply generate coupling between your spin degree of freedom and electric field. Now, if your electron is moving around the nucleus in an atom, then electric field is basically given by the moment of atomic potential. And typically, atomic potential is, atomic potential is just given by Z e squared divided by R, right? So this will be like 1 over R dV dr. And proportional to the R coordinate. So therefore, you immediately generate, say, coupling between spin and basically electric field is here, and velocity can be written as a momentum divided by mass. So the entire Hamiltonian is proportional to this, and we know that this guy. So overall angular momentum, and that's the original spin coupling with the spin overall angular momentum. And notice that the coefficient is given by this form. And given that the central potential is given by G e squared by R, G is the atomic number. And if I think about the magnitude of spin orbit coupling, then this is typically order of a potential energy divided by R cubed. And potential itself, so this guy goes like, 1 over R cubed. Potential is proportional to atomic number Z. This guy. So it's Z squared divided by R squared when I take the derivative. So it goes like, E squared divided by R cubed. And we know that average distance between nucleus and the electron when the atomic number is given by Z is typically 4 radius divided by Z. So the entire coupling is proportional to atomic number to the fourth power. So that means the spin-over coupling increases very, very rapidly. When you go to heavier, heavier atoms, the spin-over coupling becomes extremely thick. And this is kind of system that we are interested in this program.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Actually, people say Z squared. If you take numbers calculated along the periodic table, you observe Z squared.
Yeah, so let's don't get into that. I think this is a very simple atomic physics argument. So what is clear, the main message here is that if you go to a heavy and heavy element, spin-over coupling becomes bigger and bigger, and it can increase quite rapidly. For example, any other question? Good. Okay. So why we are interested in this, right? So we like to see whether such a strong spin-orbit coupling can give us some kind of new, different kinds of matter. So we are always interested in finding new phases of matter. This is one of the important goals in condensed matter physics. And typically, we do so by making a theory model. Sometimes we define, we propose some kind of interesting many body electronic state, namely wave function. But then, of course, we have to check this by doing an experiment. And experiments are typically done on some materials. So we can do this without worrying about an experiment. We can cook up all kinds of models and try to find a new phase of matter. We often do that. And some of us, indeed, have gone to places and places where no one has ever gone before. But some of these models are, however, not very realistic. Now, experimentalists can also try to discover new phases of matter. But typically, your materials are very, very complicated. So your material may contain many elements, like 3 elements, 4 elements, and there are lots of electrons in your solid. Condensed matter system. So we definitely need interaction in theory and experiment. So one nice thing about condensed matter physics is that this time period is very short. So you propose something, then your feedback may come in, say, a couple of months. So that's why I think our field is quite exciting. In fact, there was an occasion where I went to a conference. I was going to present the theory of all the experiment. Then there was an experimentalist in front of me giving a talk. The data was changed over 2 months period. So I had to scramble around, my talk, how come the data has been changed and things like that. Okay, so time scale is very short, and we need these interactions. As I said, theory modeling can be, if you really want to find the exotic phase of matter, it can be a very complicated model. And we need a balance between these two speed. And I think that's why we need Leon balance that character. Okay. So what this strong spin-orbit coupling can possibly achieve here. So we like to see mainly 2 effects. Okay. So first of all, we like to see whether spin-orbit coupling simplifies the problem. Okay, whether spin-orbit coupling simplifies the problem that we are asking. Secondly, whether spin-orbit coupling can give us new kinds of interactions. Kind of interactions. So I like to see, for example, imagine that I have no spin-orbit coupling. In general, the interaction between electrons can be very complicated. But at the same time, I have all kinds of conditions from materials or experiment that I can only have some certain kinds of interactions. I like to see when spin-orbit coupling is present, whether I can generate new kinds of interactions that can make a connection to my theory model. But that's one. So there will be like engineering interesting models using anaerobic coupling. So that's another effect I like to see. So so we often do this by thinking about the low energy effective degree of freedom, right? And when we make a model, we cannot work with all the electrons in my story. There are just too many. So I like to think of, I like to start with some low energy state. And I like to build a model out of that instead of dealing with all electrons. But at the same time, this has to be sufficiently consistent with more microscopic approaches, such as ab initio calculation. So I usually say ab initio calculation is like no electrons behind the approach. So you take into all of them, but it has to be consistent with your theory model. Okay, so I just like to give you some flavors of how we go about this, right? So why spin-orbit coupling may simplify the problem, and how you may generate new kind of interactions. Okay. So just to give you a very simple example, I like to start from a timing picture. So you may encounter, for example, some complicated materials like this. So I know that this doesn't mean anything to you. It's just some the chemical formula for the material. So I have some alkali metal, so let's say sodium. Well, here I may put just a minute. So imagine that I have to explain the experimental data of this material, what you should do. If I try to take into account all the electrons from sodium, helium, oxygen, then I'm basically bound to fail. I don't think that I can have an interesting theory out of it. Okay. So, and due to various regions, for example, in this material, we know that the main low energy electronic state mainly come from helium atoms. And electrons from sodium and oxygen are sufficiently far away from the chemical potential, if you like. Okay. So then I can focus on the electronic structure of the helium. For example, it turns out that in this system, helium carries a 4+ ionic state. And the electronic structure of this guy is like this. So it's a xenon core with a 4F14 and 5D. So you have 5 electrons in the outer D shell. So then it's clear that we want to use this degree of freedom to make a model out of this. Yeah, make sense? Yeah. Because these are the outer shell. And basically, helium makes some kind of lattice structure here. And I want to connect those alkali state. Then I like to have a model for you. It turns out this helium is sitting on the honeycomb lattice. And this helium is sitting on so-called particle lattice. That's harder to draw. It's a three-dimensional material, but you can think of that as a network of corner-sharing tetrahedron. So you fill out the entire space by making a corner-sharing of the tetrahedron. That's called particle lattice. So these regions are sitting on that three-dimensional lattice. Okay. So now I just have to consider this degree of freedom. I connect all these atomic ions, you know, put them on these lattices, then I make a lattice model out of it, right? It will be a natural course of action. So before we do so, we like to understand this fundamental building blocks, namely these 5 electrons in the D shell. First of all, my atoms are not in a free space. So if I'm in the free space, then all D orbital, remember that there are 5 D orbital, if you remember general chemistry, they are all degenerate, right? Because in free state, there's a rotational symmetry. Okay. Now, if I put this guy on a lattice, then it turns out all these helium ions are sitting inside what we call oxygen octahedron. I think I'm not drawing very well. Here it is. Okay, here's the helium. Oxygens are here, 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 here. So that means this helium, electrons in the helium is experiencing a Coulomb potential from the oxygen. So what that means is that this D overall energy level split. Okay? Energy level split. So so initially I have 5 D overall, 5 of them. So here's a 5 D shell. It's split into, in this environment, we know that it's split into two manifolds. So this is what we call EG manifold, T2D manifold. It's just a group theory literature. And what it is that here, this overall makes this manifold. Okay. So now I have 5 electrons here, and each atomic state is doubly degenerate because I can occupy them by either upspin or downspin. So meaning that I have 6 states, 5 electrons, 4 to 5 electrons, both states. So I have a partially filled manifold like this, overall, sorry.
How do you know the T is below the E?
Why T is below the E? Because of the Coulomb interaction. So you place, it's pretty simple, it's the electrostatic. If I put D, you know, you compare DX minus Y scale overall here, so the row of DX minus Y overall is going to be off the oxygen side. All this guy will be pointing to the oxygen side, so you have a lot, you have the other way around. So here you are pointing to the oxygen.
Okay, so you study the diagram and know the symmetry.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's pretty simple stuff. Yeah. Okay. Nothing so sophisticated. Okay, good. Okay, so then imagine that I have this problem and I like to solve this problem. I have 5 electrons in a degenerate overall. It turns out this is a horribly complicated problem. You can make a model. It's called Kugel-Kongsky model. It's never really properly solved, as I understand. Okay. So now the spin-orbit coupling comes in rescue. It turns out if you apply the spin-orbit coupling and this manifold becomes again split. And this state has 4 states in it, so I can occupy this state by 4 electrons. The rest of them comes here. And this is doubly degenerate, okay? And now I have a spin-orbit coupling. So what happens is as follows. So if I concentrate on this part of the atomic state, then of course, the D overall, so total angular momentum is L equal to 2, right? The D overall. So if you project this into a T2G manifold, Hilbert space of T2G state, and you can show that this guy actually acts like angular momentum 1 state. So effectively, I have angular momentum 1 object. Now you couple this to spin state. Spin is half. So I generate total angular momentum either half or 3 half. Okay. So it turns out this guy, the total angular momentum half state. This is total angular momentum 3 half state. Yeah, make sense? Correct. Okay, so that's why there are 4 states here. There are 2 states here. What is important here is that this state is the so-called Cramer's doublet. What that means is that this guy consists of time universal pattern. So J effective, the G component of this effective spin or pseudo spin, so to speak, you can have a projection up. Maybe I should say projection up and projection down. This is a pseudo-spin state, and they are Kali Gossel partners. Since I don't have a space, I go to the left. And it turns out this consists of equal mixture of all the overalls in this state. So this way, notice that this complicated problem, namely, 5 electrons, you know, degenerate, many degenerate overall, it's a completely complicated problem, simplifies to just one Cramer's doublet, effective degree of freedom, right? And then I can basically start from here. This time is all filled out, right? In either circumstances. And I can work with this. Then this guy can act as an effective degree of freedom. And I basically use this degree of freedom to build a model.
What's the energy scale for this field with splitting?
So for example, this splitting is 1.5 spinorgy coupling specs. Lambda in medium is like 0.5 electron volts. And this distance is like 3 electron volts. Okay. So in the low energy limit, basically I can basically concentrate on this degree of freedom. So that's what I mean by the statement that spinorgy coupling in principle, you know, this is one example. I'm just giving you a simplest kind. Can simplify the problem.
I missed what splits. The last split to the right.
Pardon?
What splits the four from the...
You mean this guy, this guy?
Yeah.
Oh, so that's because of spinorgy coupling, right? The L dot S.
Okay.
All right.
Just the L dot S.
Yeah, just the L dot S. Yeah, it's very simple. Yeah, again, there's just atomic physics. Okay. Now you place those guys on the lattice side. The honeycomb lattice or particle lattice. There'll be my model. Okay. It's a pseudo-spin half. Now, spinorgy coupling can also generate new kind of interactions. And by definition, what spinorgy coupling tells you is that it's a coupling between internal degree of freedom of electron, the spin quantum number, to the orbital, and orbital degree of freedom is very sensitive to lattice geometry. Right? Because it's coupled to the spatial degree of freedom. So spinorgy coupling, if you place spinorgy coupling, the type of interaction you generate in any given lattice, it's going to be very, very sensitive to lattice geometry. So for example, interactions on, with a conical lattice, interactions on particle lattice, they are not necessarily the same. The local interaction you generate may look very, very different, depending on the lattice degree of freedom. Make sense? So this is one way that which can generate interesting interactions.
But your honeycomb lattice is two-dimensional?
Yes.
So you make a sheet of this material?
That's correct. So it turns out that this material, for example, is a collection of 2D layers, and they are reasonably well separated.
So it looks a lot like graphene, but with different...
That is correct. So graphene, but again, I emphasize that the nature of interactions...
The interactions are different, but the degrees of freedom look almost exactly...
Exactly, yeah. Okay, so for good?
So time reversal invariance is going to be important.
Pardon?
Time reversal invariance will play an important role in the effect.
Yes, sir. So here, they are degenerate because it's a time reversal invariance. If you apply a magnetic field, you will split this doublet. Yeah, exactly. So another point I'd like to make is that there are situations where I have, for example, only one electron in this manifold. Imagine that I have such an atom. It turns out that the rhenium 5 plus has that. Okay. So then you have only one electron here. Okay. So then the important degree of freedom is basically J3/2 degree of freedom. Okay. Now imagine that I go to a localized electron limit where I have a strong interaction between electrons and every electron is localized. Okay. So your charge degree of freedom cannot move. But we know that they are still interacting. So the internal degree of freedom can move, right? The spins can fluctuate. Even the position of the atoms are fixed. Position of electrons are fixed. Okay, imagine such a situation. Okay. So then typically this is a spinorgy coupling. These are just some spin half object. And typically if you only think about a nearest neighbor electron interaction, the typical spin Hamiltonian will be something like, say, some interaction between spins at I and J site. Some kind of two spin interactions. So this is typically what you get. Okay. Now, but as I said, we have gone to places where no one has ever gone before. Meaning, we have models with like 16 spin exchange interactions. I have 16 operators multiplied by the spin operators. It sounds like crazy ideas, right? You cannot just make those models. I mean, materials like that. But I have a situation where I have only one electron, the J3/2 manifold. And then you can show, you write your spin operator for projecting to the particular manifold. So then this operator may look something like this. Each side, in terms of those spin, you know, J3 hub operators, when project the usual spin operator to that manifold, it may look like that. So when I make a two-body interactions like this, it immediately generates, for example, 6J operators. So there are ways to, maybe there are ways to engineer much more complicated interaction. This is actually what Leon and his former student did. Okay, so with that, so what we are trying to achieve here by generating those interactions? Okay, so say, let's speak about a generic problem that we'd like to solve. So they make a kinetic energy for the electron. So this guy is hopping around. So I'm thinking about original electron. Okay, and alpha, beta, maybe some orbital indices. And I have a spin-orbit coupling. This is atomic spin-orbit coupling. Then we have electron-electron interactions. Like that. So this is not, you know, this is not the typical Hamiltonian, but it's maybe the simplest kind. So I'd like to understand what happens, say, as a function of interaction and spin-orbit coupling stress. Okay. So then, when spin-orbit coupling is small, and we understand that there could be a transition from, for example, metal to a so-called mud insulator. And mud insulator is a correlation, the interaction driven insulator. So imagine that I have one electron per side on average. Okay. When there is no electron-electron interaction, then electrons can move around because some of the side can be doubly occupied. Electrons can hop around. Pardon?
What's
the orbital index? Orbital index. This is say dxy, yg, zx, right? Yeah. Okay. Don't take it too seriously. It's not that important. Okay. So here came a transition from metal to mud insulator. Now, if I increase spin-orbit coupling, we know that we can have a transition from, say, metals, or this can be metals, or can be a trivial band insulator. And we know from various examples that you can get an interesting state called topological insulator. In the presence of spin-orbit coupling, say even without interactions, or weak interactions, we can have this interesting state of matter. This is essentially a band insulator, but it turns out, band insulator is usually, obviously it's an insulator, there's a bulk energy gap. But this kind of insulator, there is a bulk energy gap, but the surface is gapless. Surface can be conducting. And this is one of the things that is discovered by Liang Fu, one of our organizers. So now question is, if you combine spin-orbit coupling and interaction, then what kind of phases you will get? So we typically do a phase diagram like this. So these are some simple phases that we know very well. This may be the weakly corollary topological insulator or other interesting weakly corollary state. Here we have an interaction-driven mud insulator. But here, we may have all kinds of other states. And we hope that we can generate new kinds of matter. That's basically the hope. And by doing so, we like to generate phases like what we may call spin-locking or other topological phases. So some interacting analog of, say, topological insulator, for example. And we have learned that, for example, there could be all kinds of phases like so-called topological semi-metal. It's a semi-metal with interesting topological problems. Okay, so what we really mean by topological phases here, I don't have much time, but let me try to explain very briefly. So we typically say there are type 1 and type 2 topological phases of matter. So type 1, it sounds like a string theory, but actually it's not. So type 1 is what we call intrinsic topological phase. This is what we call symmetry protected topological phases. Okay, so how do you distinguish topological phases from mundane phases? So we just said my interesting phase, so to speak, compared to trivial state. If I can connect these two phases by making a local unitary transformation, what that means is I just modify the property of my Hamiltonian or interaction only locally. If I can go from this guy to there, then obviously these two phases are the same phase. Okay. But if I have to close the gap of this state and go through a phase transition to this phase, and there's a chance that this guy is a different phase than this one. Okay. So for this type of intrinsic topological phases, you can show that there's no way to do so by changing Hamiltonian only locally. Now for this, similar thing happens, but there are two different kinds of ways that I can possibly connect these two phases. Okay, so here, I impose certain symmetries. So I impose certain symmetries to some local symmetries to topological phase and trivial phase. And if this local unitary transformation or the path, if this guy is breaking symmetry, then this, then this path is allowed. If you preserve the symmetry along the path, then this is null. And the most famous example is this trivial band insulator and topological insulator. So topological insulator example is protected by time-versus symmetry. So therefore, if you try to transform one phase to the other by making a local transformation, by preserving time-versus symmetry, then you cannot deform this state to the other. Okay.
Aren't topological phases sort of characterized by non-local order parameters?
Yes. So I will mention that very briefly too. Yes. So, but if you are willing to break time as a symmetry, then you can construct a path that can connect these two phases. In that sense, this type of topological phase is maybe different from this. And this topological insulator is an example of type. And type 1 topological phases, the most famous example is the Pfaff-Holstein. And another example is the spin electron. Okay. So since I promised that I'll talk about gauge field, I'm gonna talk about spin electron. But that's probably the most relevant instead of topological insulators. Okay. So this idea of spin liquid came about 10 years ago by thinking about high-tech cube plate problem. So the original problem was like this: imagine that I have some interaction between strings localized at different sides. In particular, imagine that they are exchanging interactions anti-ferromagnetic type, meaning that J is positive, so the spins in nearby site wants to be anti-aligned. And you could add some small perturbation, but maybe it doesn't matter so much. And the desire, that there was a desire to create a non-trivial quantum paramagnetic state, something that doesn't order magnetically. So each thing to do, you know, scale-wise, maybe you just order anti-ferromagnetically. you just break the symmetry, spin rotational symmetry, and you just get into anti-parallel mapping. But imagine that I want to create something more interesting, the quantum parallel magnet. This essentially is something translation invariant. Okay? So how do you do that? So by thinking about the anti-ferromagnetic interaction, the natural thing about for the two-side problem is to create a spin singlet object, which is ij psi. And you call that some kind of, basically you can make some kind of valence bond singlet. Okay? So this is, spin zero object, and I can imagine placing them on a lattice somewhere like that. And this is clearly a paramagnetic state as the single state. Okay. But if I do that, then I'm basically breaking translation symmetry. So it's against my principle. I want to generate something translation invariant. Okay. So how I do that? One way to do that is think about all kinds of other valence bond configuration, something different. I think about all possible covering of the lattice. Can I do the linear superposition of that? Okay. So then clearly it's still singular state, translation invariant, and that's called regulating valence bond state. Basically, the quantum superposition of all valence bond covering. That'd be my regulating valence bond state. Yeah, makes sense? So, but this is a cartoon picture. How can we substantiate this idea? So one way to do so is to start from a superconductor. Looks very, sounds very strange, but it turns out this is the easiest route to get there. So think about a BCS superconductor, but in such a way that average number of electron per sign is 1. So it's a superconductor, there's a lot of charge fluctuations, right? Charge is not even conserved in superconductor. Quasi particle charge is not conserved. Charge is not a good quantum number. But I can define the average number of electron per second as 1. Okay, in this situation, I can write out a Bichet's wave function. In real space, Bichet's wave function looks like this. Acting on a vacuum. This is basically a coherent state. Or Cooper pairs, up and down pairs, and GRI prime is a Cooper pair wave function. Okay. Now I take this BCS wave function, but now imagine that I add strong one side interaction, namely that I cannot have more than one electron per side. So U goes infinity level. Then I know that I have exactly one electron per second. Okay, here, the Ni is exactly 1. Okay, electrons don't move. Obviously, this is an insulator. Yeah? By going to the infinity limit, I generate an insulator. Okay. Then I ask what kind of insulator this is. So this is, if you like, construction of RVB state, I state. You do the projection, meaning you take U equals infinity limit so that I generate an insulator starting from this superconductor. That will be my regulating valence bond state. And in fact, one could show in some limit that if you write regulating valence bond wave function at the sum over valence bond configuration, the sum position, sum of all possible valence bond covering. So this valence bond covering is one of those. Then this amplitude of valence bond covering will be product of this Cooper pair wave function. So this is a sort of explicit construction of a symmetric wave function, if you like. Okay. Now imagine that I generate such a state. Why this state is topological? So now imagine that instead of playing, imagine that I have a two-dimensional system. Instead of plane, I put these guys on the top, on the cylinder. So the surface of the cylinder is my original superconductor. I impose a large U limit, meaning that I have only one electron per side. I generate an insulator. This is my RGB state, spin leak state. So this guy, what I'm going to do is I'm going to thread the HCB over two vortex inside the cylinder. Then my wave function becomes anti-periodic in one direction. The Cooper Pell wave function becomes anti-periodic in one direction. Okay, so as it is, if I do this in a superconductor, this is in a high energy state, excited state. On the other hand, if you do the projection, remember that this is projected superconducting wave function. This I call RGB prime. So I have a BCS prime, that means I have a one flux inserted to the center of the cylinder. Then this guy, before projection, is a high energy state. After projection, under certain condition, they become degenerate in energy. And on the other hand, if you compute the overlap between these two states, and that overlap goes to zero exponentially. So meaning that in the thermodynamic limit, I generate two degenerate ground states, but they are orthogonal. So that means there are two degenerate ground states on a cylinder. You play the same game on a torus, you found that there are four degenerate ground states. Okay. So in that sense, this spin leak state I constructed here. It's a topological state.
So
in the sense
when they become degenerate, they become degenerate at some limit.
Degenerate in the thermodynamic limit. Yeah, it's always in the higher energy state. But in the limit that L goes to infinity, then it becomes degenerate. Yeah. Actually, it turns out what actually happens is that this, yeah, okay, let's don't go into too much details. Yes.
What's so, L? Is that the length of the cylinder?
Yeah, L is the length of the cylinder. That's correct. Okay. Good. Another way to understand this is as follows. If you think about, so you have to think about this more intuitively. Useful to more than explain details, and then that I make a combination of these two states. So I can make a symmetric and anti-symmetric combination of these two states. Then imagine I go into a very, very short coherence length limit. Superconductor to begin with. So meaning the size of my Cooper pair is a lot of spacing. Okay? So then when I think about those states in the cylinder, so I have a Cooper pairs. Those are basically my single diamonds, if you like. So there are, you know, I can place all these diamond coverings. So what happens is that this guy is a superposition of some kind of valence bond covering. This is also a superposition of some valence bond covering. That for the even state, if you say cut one of those lines like that, the number of diamonds you cross in this line is always an even number. If you do that here, it's always an odd number, and you can convince yourself that you can, you know, you cannot go from here to there. Every time I move around, I change my two. So it's all, you know, this guy only contains the even number of crossings here. This guy only contains odd number of crossings here. There is a topological distinction between these states. So there's another way to see that you generate a topological state. Okay. Another interesting thing about this construction is that remember that in superconductor, the elementary excitations are so-called Bolle-Kozy particles. And if you have only average number of electrons per site to be one, is Bolle-Kozy particles equal mixture of particle and Hall state. So what that means is that average charge of those Bolle-Kozy particles is zero. They carry spin half, but average charge is zero. Remember that Kozy particle charge is not conserved, so you can only define an average charge, not the definite charge for those particles. Now, when I go to a larger limit to construct this spin leak state, then I start from a Bolle-Kozy particle, So this carries average charge zero spin half. Then I do the projection, I generate insulator. Then what this excitation becomes to is you get a zero charge spin half quantum number. And these are called spin-on. Basically, this particle can be only the spin quantum number of the original electron, charge orbital. So this is what we call electron fractionalization. Maybe it's not a proper name, but that's the way we use it. Sounds like electron is actually physically separate anyway, but that's not the case, right? These are the many particle excited state, right? Okay. So addressed by many particle cloud. Okay. So why I'm talking about all this? Because using spin-orbit coupling, we think that we can generate an interesting model for this kind of state. And this famous model is called Guattari model. Leo said that the biggest mystery here is why Guattari left KITP. Maybe that's what it is. But Guattari proposed the following model. This is a model of the honeycomb lattice that I talked about. So you have X, Y, Z link. So along the X bond, I have eigen coupling, but only along XX, SX component. Y direction, I have SY, SY coupling, Z direction, SG, SG coupling. It looks like a very simple model, right? But the point is that this model is very frustrated. What that means is that you can convince yourself, when you try to place spins here, you can convince yourself that you can generate a large number of equally unhappy spin configurations. None of them is happy. But this is called frustrated interactions. So this is the perfect place where we expect to see a quantum paramagnet, where you know the motion of the spins are highly correlated, but it's not a sum of individual spins. Nonetheless, there is no magnetic ordering. Okay. It turns out, Guattari sold this model and show that the ground zero of this guy is of this kind. The spin linkage that I talked about. Why gauge field? It turns out the underlying theory is a G2 gauge theory. How much time do I have? Maybe negative time.
No, the time.
Okay, good. So maybe I can explain.
Could you make a question?
Yeah. So maybe I can briefly explain why this becomes a KD theory. So Guattari solved this model in the following fashion. So by examining basically what he did. Once we examine the total number of degree of freedom, the total number of constraint, then he realized that the natural basis to solve this problem is using Meyer algorithm. Just count the number of available Hilbert space, okay. Counting conditions and number of degree of freedom. So he solved this model as follows. So imagine that I represent all spin, a component of spin by product of two Meyer algorithm. So all of these things are real value fermions. Then this model can be written as like that. So with the, maybe I should say I, 2i, half i. I'm going to do that. Okay, so then you can rewrite it as okay. So now look at this variable. This is a product of two minor fermions. For each direction, for x direction, I have chi x chi y, y direction I have chi x chi y. Okay. Bilinear. It turns out this operator commutes with a total Hamiltonian. It becomes a constant of motion. And eigenvalue of this guy is always plus minus one. Okay. So that means this problem becomes quadratic. Anybody can solve a quadratic Hamiltonian. So we designed to do that, right? That's all our education is for, right? Free Fermion is a harmonic oscillator, isn't it? Is that the only problem that we can solve? So, okay. So what that means is that this guy is a constant of motion. So I actually can fix those values. So it turns out that the ground state is such that if you think about product of Uij operators around the plucket, so that determines the plucket operator. So this is a loop product of Uij alpha. And the eigenvalue of this guy is always plus minus one. And you can show that the ground state of this model can be obtained if I set all WP to be plus one. And there are many, many configurations of Uij. And you can easily show that they are all related by G2K transform. Basically, you do a discrete transformation SR equals plus minus one. The Uij will change to SI Uij as J. And this is the only gauge in the operator. This is only a meaningful guy. I can choose some gauge. So if I set this guy, all of them to be plus one, there's one gauge. And that basically set the stage.
So it's like a Z2 gauge theory.
Yes, it is a G2 gauge. This is the Eigen gauge theory. Okay. So if I have three more minutes, then I can explain why this picture is related to the previous picture. Because there's no connection, it looks like. Right?
Probably you don't know, but it's almost identical to what we call the quantum link model for gauge theories.
Yeah, I mean, well, you know that every solvable model is related to another solvable model.
Well, we couldn't solve it because we were trying to do four dimensions for anybody.
Okay, yeah. It's good to know. Maybe I can think about a four-dimensional material.
We argued that that was the same as QCD.
Okay, yeah. Sounds great. Good. So what this construction has anything to do with this VCS construction? You know, what's the connection to that? So for that, you can think about making a complex fermion out of this minor fermion by combining two of those objects. And also complex conjugate of this guy. Okay? I don't trust this plus and minuses, but something like this. Okay, then using this representation, I can rewrite the entire model as follows. The entire model can be written as with some specific matrix element for this and that. Notice that this represents the hopping of those complex fermions. This represents the pairing between fermions. This is actually the spin triplet version of the VCS superconductor, except that if you impose this condition, I didn't say important thing here, because there's a constraint on the Majorana fermion to satisfy the Hilbert space size consistent, then one can show that in order to be consistent, I should impose a condition. The number of fermions per psi has to be always exactly one. And this is precisely the condition I talked about. Fermion to be number to be exactly one. This is spin triplet version of what I said. Then it's clear from this equation why P theory is G2K theory. If I don't have this guy, and if I only have hopping term, then I have a U1 gauge invariance. Namely, Fi alpha goes e to the I sigma I Fi alpha. Then I can transform this could we say, you know, I can define a phase vector. Then the corresponding transformation will be Aij to the Aij plus theta I minus theta j. So this is the lattice U1 gauge theory. But this guy creates a symmetry. This guy is actually a charge to Higgs, if you like. Right? And that breaks the U1 symmetry down to G2. And that's why this represents the G2 gauge theory. And that connects to this exact solution. And as it is, Uij is the static field in the exact solution. It's the dynamics of this time. On the other hand, so here, obviously, this is only the static. But imagine that now I add all kinds of other interaction, and that's actually what happens in real material. You know, you cannot just generate one term like this, it turns out. You generate all sorts of terms. Then notice that these are not constant motion anymore, becomes dynamical field. Then I have to solve strong coupling gauge theory, lattice gauge theory. And that's what you guys are good for. Okay? So I think I'm going to end this talk like that.
More questions? So this label was over the three links, but
yes.
It's become four. It goes from zero to three.
Actually, I have to include the four minor upon there. So for example, for Si x, I have I chi naught chi, so chi naught chi x. Well, other component I have, let me call 1, 2, z component will be chi 0, chi 3. So chi naught is common.
I see.
Yeah. And I didn't say, but what actually happens is that the solution of the quadratic Hamiltonian gives you Dirac formulas. So you get a G2 gauge theory for the Dirac formula. Yeah? G2 gauge for Dirac formulas. And here, this Hamiltonian, the corresponding Bichet Hamiltonian, so to speak, also has a Dirac formula in it.
What do you mean by this quadratic? I mean, you freeze the loops and then you do the quadratic interval in the chi zeros? Is that what you mean by
yes.
quadratic?
Yes. And, yes. So it's not dynamic. It's the constant motion.
Right, but I mean, there's a different solution for each plus and minus of every loop?
Okay, yeah. So if you set some of the loops, okay. Yeah. So ground state is, you can show that the ground state can be reached if loop product for all these products plus one.
Yes.
You can generate another state by changing WP equals minus one for some loop. Yeah. Those guys are in higher energy.
Right, that's just a slice of the Hilbert space. It's a constraint that's not really part of the original model.
That's just not the ground state of the Hamiltonian.
Right, it's a slice.
Once you fix the chi I,
yes.
Chi zero is fixed by the constraint, no?
Yeah, so you mean the chi I, chi j, chi
no. This quadratic constraint.
Right, so chi j, so basically what gives you the Dirac formula is this the chi zero formula. Because hopping on a lattice, it generates dispersion. On the other hand, chi a formulas don't have a dispersion. Don't have basically.
Chi zero is fixed once you fix those.
You mean, are you saying if I fix chi a, I'm not fixing chi a, I'm fixing uij a. That's a different thing. I'm just picking the link there.
But the real theory is not this. I mean, this is just a slice. This is a constraint on the real theory. I mean, on your original.
Well, you can compute the energy, then that's the ground state. Okay. Yeah. Nothing more than that.
Okay.
Yeah. So you're worrying about dynamics, right?
Yes.
Basically, what happens is that if you add other terms so that this model is not exactly solvable, then uij is not a constant of motion. Then Uij will fluctuate.
I see.
Will fluctuate between all these loop configurations.
Yeah, I'm sorry. It completely block diagonalizes in this. That's
right. Yeah. So all these loop configurations will
right.
fluctuate.
I understand. Okay.
So then, when the loop proliferate,
yeah.
you have a confinement transition. So actually, you have a here this phase I talk about. It's a deconfined phase of G2 gauge theory.
So would you have a real gauge term? Laplace term would come.
Yes. So for example, if this guy becomes dynamic, then we generate UIJ over epsilon.
A real gauge period.
Yes, exactly. So, and this is basically that, you know, WP acquires the dynamics. And the string tension is basically.
That this is an example of the quantum link problem.
Great, sure. I learned something.
So what happens if you take the BCS delay and increase U continuously?
So this argument only works at this single point, U equals infinity. Okay. So now the question is whether even if U is finite, whether we can get this thing. I think that's more than dependent. So the simple answer is I don't know.
I mean, whether depending on the G,
yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think so.
So is there a mapping into Staggered trees?
Staggered trees.
You're talking about getting a Dirac action in the.
Yeah, so you get a Dirac fermion.
Strain on the loops looks like one way of writing.
It's a dynamical.
All right, well, a reminder everybody, continue at 5 o'clock. Thank you.